This is Herb Montgomery, and I want to take this opportunity to thank all of you who are supporting the work of Renewed Heart Ministries. It's people like yourself that enable us to exist and to be a positive resource in our world in the work of survival, resistance, liberation, restoration, and transformation. If you're unfamiliar with Renewed Heart Ministries, we are a not-for-profit group that is passionate about centering a set of values and ethics in the experiences of those on the undersides and margins of our society. Informed also by the sayings and the teachings of the historical Jewish Jesus of Nazareth. If you'd like to support our work, I'll tell you how you can do so at the end of this podcast. But for now, we simply want to thank you for listening. Thank you so much for those kind words. How are you this morning? Good. I am so glad to be back in Glendale. I absolutely love your church, and you are one of the highlights of my year. I have been looking forward to being back here ever since I left last year. So thank you for extending to me another invitation. If you need a handout this morning, they are in your bulletin. Does everyone have one of these? Because you're going to need one to follow along with me. If you don't have one, please raise your hand, and we'll get you one just as quickly as possible. Thank you, Todd, and others who are being minute people. The title this morning, which for reasons I hope will become clearer as we proceed, is the healing of our world. And what I would like to do is look at the teachings of Jesus, or look at just a few examples in the Jesus narrative, that we're looking from the perspective not as Jesus being a post-mortem savior, not as Jesus being someone who gives us post-mortem assurance, but rather the potential or the relevance of Jesus' teachings to efforts to make our world a safer, just, more compassionate home for all of us. What do Jesus' teachings, what is the intrinsic value of Jesus' sayings and his teachings to our world right now? Christians have, sectors of Christianity, have been guilty of ignoring great swaths of injustice in the present, being primarily concerned with passing out post-mortem fire insurance policies. How many understand what I mean by that? And we're going to abandon that perspective of looking at Jesus' teachings just for this morning. If that brings you lots of comfort, you can return to it by 11 o'clock, I promise. But at least for right now, what do Jesus' teachings have to say to us in the present? We're going to begin with John chapter 20. And John's gospel, if I can be transparent with you, John's gospel is my least favorite. Now, I know that some of you, it is like your bread and butter. It's the one you love the most. I do not like the gospel of John. I prefer the synoptic gospels myself. There is a stark difference, and I think we could all at least agree on that. There's a stark difference between John and the other three. How many have noticed that? They're foreign to each other. There are various theories as to why this is. Most of the theories out there can be categorized at least into two categories that have to do with the early seeds of or early forms of Gnosticism. You can't read Irenaeus of the second century and not see that John is directly addressing a Gnostic worldview and a Gnostic system of beliefs. If you could even systematize Gnosticism. Gnosticism is so hard to categorize. Just to throw this out there, and again, these are generalizations. This would not be true of every Gnostic, but this will make sense to you as we continue. One of the things that Gnostics believed was a separation between body and soul. The great hope was to liberate the soul from its oppressive shell of the body. Within certain sectors of Gnosticism, there was a great push towards egalitarianism between the sexes. They valued the voices of women equally with the voices of men. That was very problematic to a patriarchal Orthodox Christianity in the early days,
And so you have this tension between Orthodox Christianity very early and Gnostic Christianity. Something else that Gnostics were favorable towards is, and they had this in common actually with Paul, one of the few things they had in common with Paul, is they focused primarily on the living Jesus. How is Jesus revealing himself to you right now? Very subjective, very little interest in the actual historic Jesus, as far as the Jewish Jesus. It's about the living, the resurrected Christ and the living present Christ. That's just kind of a taste of Gnosticism. This wasn't true for all Gnostics. But one of the things about the living Christ as well, they would draw straws every week. They didn't have like a clergy. They didn't have a hierarchy of authority within their gatherings. They would draw straws every week to see who would be teaching next week. And anybody could teach because it was all about just sharing. And to some of you that sounds very refreshing. But it was just everybody sharing what the living Christ is saying to you right now. That's early Gnosticism. Now, if we look at the Gospel of John through this lens, John is one of two categories. It's either an inclusive gospel that's trying to embrace or include or bring in Gnostic believers still with establishing Orthodox hierarchy under the authority of the church, trying to reach out to the Gnostics. Or some believe that it was actually written to oppose and as an apologetic against the Gnostics. I'm undecided. All I can determine is that there are deep Gnostic roots in the Gospel of John. Whomever the author of John was, he did have some agendas. One of the agendas we're looking at here in John 20, he asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, he said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the," what does it say? Talk to me this morning. "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. Lots of scholars have noticed that one of the agendas of the author of John, is to create a second Genesis, where Genesis was the beginning of the world to the Hebrew tradition. John was attempting at making an attempt at becoming a second Genesis. Genesis 1 starts off with what phrase? Talk to me now. John chapter 1 starts off with what phrase? Many scholars have observed that just like in the original, well, not the original, but one of the older ancient post-Babylonian Jewish creation stories, there are 7 days to that story, to that narrative. In John, the whole book of John is structured after 7 signs, as if Jesus is the beginning of a new world. In John chapter 20, what we're seeing is another parallel here with Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 3, woman is the first to be deceived. And ladies, you have been paying the price for that story ever since. Mercy. And Jesus, or John, whoever wrote the Gospel of John, he's contrasting Genesis 3 here with the resurrection. We find another woman now who's in a garden once again. Whom does she mistake Jesus for being? The gardener. But now the whole original narrative is turned on its head. The woman is now no longer the first to be deceived. She's the first to be enlightened. She's the first to have the courage to believe. She's the first to actually be sent to the other apostles. She's what some have called an apostle to the apostles. The woman is the first in the Gospel of John. How many ladies in the room does that resonate with? 1, 2, 3. All right, the rest of you, it might as we go on. But the Gospel of John is trying to reverse the Genesis 3 story and saying, yes, that might have been within their own first century worldview. That might have been the beginning of the old world and how things were structured. This is going to be the beginning of a new world. Very Gnostic, very egalitarian, very affirming of women. Now, this was not just true of John because of its Gnostic tendencies. This is also true of some other passages in other Gospels. Look with me, if you will, in Luke chapter 10. And Jesus And his disciples were on their way. He came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted about all the preparations that had to be made. And she came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." Now, one of the things we don't readily notice about this story, because we're so far removed from this culture, is that when a rabbi was teaching, anybody could be present in the room, but there was a special location for the women who were listening. Where was that? Does anyone know? Well, if you were listening, if you were present taking advantage of the discourse, where would you have to remain? In the back. That's right. You were in the back of the room. The men had the nice, comfortable seats. But if you were training or you were aspiring to be a rabbi yourself, there was one special place for you, and that was what in our culture we call front row seating. Back then it was to be, you were the only ones that were allowed to actually come up and sit at the rabbi's feet. In IVP New Testament background commentary on Luke 10:39, people normally sat on chairs or at banquets reclined on couches, but disciples sat at the, what does it say? The feet of their teacher. Serious disciples were preparing to be teachers, a role not in this culture permitted to women. Mary's posture and eagerness to absorb Jesus' teachings at the expense of a more traditionally womanly role would have shocked most Jewish men. And we find in this story not just the men. Martha comes out not concerned with the dishes, really. It's not that she's been left with all the domestic duties by herself. She walks into the room, yes, wondering why she's been left with all the domestic duties, but she looks around the room and she does not find her sister standing in the back. Where does she find her sister seated? There are so many culturally constructed boundaries that Mary is transgressing to sit at Jesus' feet. What Martha is really saying is not, "I've been left with all the duties, tell her to help out, she's being lazy." It's, "Jesus, look where she's seated. Would you please put my sister back in her place?" There's much more to this story than just helping out at potluck time. And Jesus turns and what does he say? "Oh yeah, I messed up." Is that what Jesus says? "Oh yeah, Mary, your sister's right. I mean, this has been fun, but it's good while it lasted." Now, what does he say? In a very countercultural way, he affirms Mary and says, "No, it's okay for her to sit here. She belongs here too." I think it's anachronistic to say that Jesus, living in Roman and Jewish patriarchy, was a feminist. I don't believe that's true. But I do believe he did push some gender boundaries and gender definitions within his own time. One of the most striking for me, well, before we get to that, look at 8, 1 through 2. This is what hints to it for me. After this, Jesus traveled about from one town and village to another, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. And the 12 were with them, and also some women who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. Mary called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had come out. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, and the manager of Herod's household, which is economically significant, not just gender, Susanna, and many others. These women were helping to support them out of their own what? Means. What does that tell you? Listen, I'm the director of a nonprofit. I know firsthand, people don't support you out of their means unless they resonate with something you're sharing, something you're doing, something you're trying to accomplish. Your goals in life have to parallel at least their goals in life for you to write a check. Does that make sense? So these women were actually supporting Jesus financially. That at least whispers to us that these women in the first century saw something of value in what Jesus was doing that was relevant to them and their daily plight that they experienced as being a woman in first century Palestine. They were willing to support this even sacrificially. Matthew 19, 4 through 5. I missed this for many years, but in one of the discourses on divorce, and we need to be very careful with Jesus' words on divorce. It is unfortunate that we would take his comments on divorce out of a first century patriarchal context and try to apply them to situations that we are encountering today in our cultural context. In that context, women could not divorce men. Men could only divorce women. If you were a Pharisee after the school of Hillel, you could actually divorce a woman for something as simple as burning your toast at dinner time. And ladies, there is always a newer model walking by on the sidewalk. In a culture where a woman's to live, her life depended upon being connected to either a husband or a father, there was grave injustice in a system that not only subjugated women in that way and made her dependent, but also allowed her to be so vulnerable that she could be sent away for something so trite. If that makes sense to you, say yes. So in that social justice context, Jesus is saying, even though he's not changing the patriarchal structure, which, if I'm honest, I wish he would have. He could have gotten crucified for that instead. But if he would have attempted to change the patriarchal structure, fine. At least within a patriarchal structure that's intact, he's saying, men, if you're going to divorce her, it needs to only be, because there's a lot more here involved. There's economic, there's life here involved. You can only do so if there is sexual. It's one of the few times that Jesus actually sides with the Pharisees of the school of Shammai, which we don't have time to go into all of that. But even after the fall of Jerusalem, even most Jewish rabbis rejected the school of Shammai for the more progressive understanding of Torah from Hillel. But the fact that Jesus, on this case, sided with Shammai and said, no, just sexual immorality. This was an act of justice. This was a call for justice. But what I want you to notice in saying all of that, what I want you to notice here is the shift Jesus makes with the text. And I think it's also anachronistic to say Jesus was a higher critic of his sacred text. But there's something going on here that Jesus is doing with the text that we need to allow ourselves the permission to do as well. In Matthew 19, 4 through 5, this is the discussion on divorce in Matthew's version of the Jesus story. Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become flesh, one flesh. Now, how many are familiar with Genesis 1 and 2? Anyone here familiar with those two narratives? You realize those are two different creation stories. How many realize that first? How many realize they're contradicting creation stories? There's an order contradiction there. They're two different stories. Matter of fact, in Genesis 2, this is not what it says. Jesus is not quoting this right. In Genesis 2, it states the reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife and the two become one flesh is not because God made both of them. It's because Adam was made in the image of God, and she was taken from Adam. How many know Genesis 2? In other words, this is what Paul uses in the New Testament to maintain a position of submission for women to men. Man is the glory of, how many have read this from Paul? And woman is the glory of, anybody nauseated yet? There's this hierarchical. Jesus could have said, listen, man is the glory of God and woman is the glory of man. And woman came from man, and that is why a man leaves father and mother and they cleave back together because she was originally taken from him and now they're coming back. That's Genesis 2. Instead, Jesus subverts Genesis 2, and he quotes Genesis 1 instead. In the beginning, the Creator made them What is this story that he's referencing? Genesis 1:27. So God created humankind in God's own image. In God's own image, the Creator created them, male and female. God created them. What is Jesus doing with this subversive treatment of the text? He's actually saying, no, you're not made in the image of God and she's made in the image of you. In the beginning, you both were made in the image of God. We don't realize how revolutionary it was for a Jewish male in a Roman Jewish world in the first century to make such a statement that women were just as equally bearers of the image of God as men were in his own time. That is profound. Yes. Yes, we are still late to that party. For him, 2,000 years ago, to say that women just as equally bore the image of God. That's profound, is it not? That's why I don't understand. April 16, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in his now famous letter from the Birmingham jail, writing to white clergymen, both Jewish and Christian, writing in response to a letter that had been published attacking King and the Birmingham campaign under the title, are you ready for this? A Call for Unity. That ring any bells? He writes, so here we are moving toward the exit of the 20th century with a religious community largely adjusted to the status quo. Standing as a taillight behind other community agencies rather than a headlight leading men to higher levels of justice. He was complaining about his religious communities being taillights and labeling as evil movements in society which were largely at work to end the suffering of a certain demographic. And the church was not just failing to pioneer the effort. King's actually being too kind here. They're not even being taillights in the movement, bringing up the rear. They were in opposition to it. Listen, my friends are fighting in civil society for the equal rights, for non-discrimination towards our LGBTQ siblings, that they would have equal rights to work, equal rights to housing, that they can't be kicked out of their homes, that they would have public access to public services the same way others do. This is the world we're living in, and it is an embarrassment for a church to still be arguing with something that society settled 100 years ago. Are you hearing me? Forgive me. I'm looking at the age demographic in this room, and I may not be invited back for saying this. There's a reason why my age demographic is not present this morning. It's because this is asinine and too late. This is far beyond taillights. Secular society settled this in 19, 15, 16, and 17. And we're still arguing about it? Even when we have a woman prophet? Does anyone feel the disconnect? Forgive me, I come from Appalachia, so maybe I'm venting a little bit this morning. Thanks for being a safe space. I'm done. That's all I'll say on the matter. But it is an embarrassment that we're still having to traverse this ground. Now, we've looked at gender inequality a little bit in the Jesus story, but really that's not what the Jesus story is about. You have to extract, and I've done my best this morning to extract egalitarianism from the Jesus story this morning. How many can see it there? It's faint. Again, Jesus wasn't a feminist. You can see that. But he was pushing some envelopes, at least in this area. Where Jesus really shines is not the hierarchy of gender, but the hierarchy of class. If your gospel is not, first and foremost, good news to the poor, we have to at least ask ourselves whether our Jesus is the same one that's in the story. Jesus' attack of classism and economic hierarchy and economic structures that create poverty, that make a division between the wealthy and the impoverished. This is the Jesus story. In 1908, turn of the century, last century, revolutionary book for its time, Adolf Deisman wrote the book Light from the Ancient East. And this was an introduction to understanding this for modern Christians today. He wrote this. This is on the next page. Such sayings of the non-literary Jesus have been reported to us by others, and such non-literary letters as remain to us of St. Paul show us, watch this, that Christianity in its earliest creative period was most closely bound up with which class? The lower classes, and had as yet no effective connection with the small upper class possessed of power and culture. In his book, New Light on the New Testament from the Records of the Greco-Roman Period, page 7, he writes, by its very nature, primitive Christianity stood contrasted with the upper class, not at first as Christianity, not as a religion, but as a movement of the proletarian lower class. Now he's sounding like Marx. This was a lower class movement. Jesus was not a middle class Jew. That's Paul. If Paul was kicked into a ditch, he could appeal to Caesar. If Jesus was kicked into a ditch, Jesus was not also a Roman citizen. He was just a poor Jewish man in a ditch. There's a little bit of privilege that we have to understand in Paul that he's writing from the perspective of when he writes. Jesus didn't have equal privileges of Paul. Howard Thurman, by the way, in his book, The Disinherited Jesus, is who enlightens us on some of the background of that. Jesus primarily focused on class hierarchy. And that is why it was so popular among the lower classes. Jesus was not middle class. He was not upper class. In Luke, it tells us that when he was brought by his parents to be dedicated, that Mary and Joseph brought two doves according to Torah. The problem is the Torah doesn't say bring two doves. It says bring a lamb. If you're too poor, bring two doves. Which tells us that Jesus' parents were parents who longed to give the best to their child, but couldn't afford it. They had to give the best they could. That is a very different perspective for Jesus to emerge in first century Judaism out of. Jesus belonged to a demographic of the low. He understood what that was like. And his teachings were specifically aimed at helping the poor survive. His teachings on mutual aid and resource sharing. To resist. Jesus didn't teach them to submit. He taught them to resist oppression and injustice. And that's Matthew 5. And yes, he taught nonviolently. And I talked about that the last time I was here. If you have questions, we can go back to that presentation. But he taught nonviolent resistance. He taught not just resistance and survival. He taught liberation. Not only did he teach economic liberation, he taught restoration. He taught transformation for society, not personal, private, but within a societal model. And today, I think we could take from some of this. Certainly, there's room to, if we did nothing more than just look at Jesus's solution to income or wealth inequality. If that's all we did, how many would say there's something relevant in Jesus's teachings to the sufferings on this planet today? If that's all we extrapolated from them. By the way, a TED Talk that you may be interested in is Richard Wilkinson's 2011 TED Talk, How Economic Inequality Harms Societies, and there's a link for that right there. If that's all we took from Jesus was just at face value what Jesus taught economically, then it would be a betterment for our world today and the one in which we live. But we don't have to stop there. There's not just economic pyramids of oppression on our planet today. There are also gender pyramids of oppression. And let's be honest, which gender is at the top? I can say this, male. Am I right? And there's not just gender pyramids of oppression. There's racial pyramids of oppression as well. And it seems the wider you are, the closer to the top you are. And where you land in that pyramid is strictly dependent upon the pigmentation of your skin. The darker you are, the more towards the bottom you get placed in our unjust societal structures. Does Jesus have something to say about survival, resistance, liberation, restoration, and transformation in matters of race? Even though he never dealt with it directly, could we extrapolate the same principles that he taught with economics and apply them to gender and racial inequalities? Could we do that? And not just that. There are orientation pyramids of the whole world is made for a white straight male. Is there a place, is there a relevance to the injustice that the LGBTQ community faces every day? Is there relevance in Jesus' teachings for them? For liberation, survival, and resistance. See, this is much more than just getting your ticket to heaven, isn't it? And specifically within the LGBTQ community, with gender expression, those who find themselves gender nonconforming or forget binary labels, even their sexuality is fluid, unlabelable. Our society is not structured, nor is it policed, to benefit those people groups. Is there something relevant in the Jesus story for them? I wrote this 2 weeks ago in our e-site that we send out every week, and I recorded this in our weekly podcast. There is an intrinsic relationship of cause and effect between inequality and societal harm. Whether the inequality is rooted in disparities based on gender, class, race, orientation, gender identity, age, ability, whatever, history bears out the fruit of inequality is not security in facing the future, but greater vulnerability and risk for us all. None of us are free until all of us are free. And yet in Jesus' teachings, there is something that has the power there to liberate us all together. This is why John called it a second Genesis. It was the beginning of a whole new world. So in John, we find this passage very early in his gospel. For God did not send his son into the world to, what does it say? If that is what your Jesus following is characterized by, it's time for a different Jesus. Condemnation is not what Jesus was known for. And it is time that Jesus' followers no longer become defined by condemnation, specifically condemnation of those things which, although they are an effort to improve the lives of others, condemnation of those things that threaten one's own position of privilege and benefit in the status quo. Those are the things we typically condemn. Now, maybe it's different in Southern California than it is where I'm from. Most definitely it's different. But we reserve our condemnation. Recently, two of the things that I have been grappling with is the silence of my fellow Christians in the face of police brutality toward people of color. The silence is deafening in my neck of the woods. The only time my fellow Christian siblings speak up is when something's getting burnt to the ground. I was in Baltimore marching with others, alongside of others, during in the wake of the murder of Freddie Gray. And I was there, as I was there listening to the speeches at one of the rallies, one of the young men said, "Are you listening to me? Or do I need to burn something else down?" Jesus taught us to value people over power, people over profit, and people over property. And when Christians are silent in the face of destroyed lives, only vocal when property is being destroyed, it betrays that we have become more capitalistic than Christian. We need to be careful what we condemn. God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to, what does it say? Say, but that the world might be saved through him. And you know as well as I do, that word save can be translated heal just as much as save, depending on its context. But the definition means to save, to keep safe. To keep safe. To keep safe and sound. To rescue from danger and destruction. Some people need rescued from the danger and destruction of our Jesus, much less a Jesus who's saving them from danger and destruction. To make well, to heal, to restore, to preserve one who is in danger of destruction, to save or rescue. I want to be a Jesus follower that's characterized by that. How many would agree with me this morning? That's what I want to be. I want to be a safe place for people around me whose experience in life is not like mine, who have to go through things that I will never firsthand understand because I don't firsthand experience them. It is high time that we start seeing Jesus through the lens not just of post-mortem glory, but through present liberation for those who are suffering. And yes, there will be times when what Jesus says, I'm sure it happened for some of you this morning, doesn't feel like good news. We're so American. We want everything to be positive and happy and just a good life. Someone once said, "Herb, if it's not good news, it's not the gospel," as if that was supposed to keep me quiet. And I responded, I said, "Did Jesus preach the good news?" "Oh, yes, Jesus preached the gospel. It was the good news." I said, "Well, how about Caiaphas, Herod, and Pilate? Did they feel like it was good news when they heard it?" No, Jesus' good news was not good news to them. Matter of fact, it was very threatening to them, so threatening that they together combined enemies previous. They together combined their efforts to remove this threat. Are you hearing me this morning? Peter Gomes, in his book, The Scandalous Gospel of Jesus, says the teachings of Jesus were not about niceness. Jesus preached, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. That's good news to which group? It's at least problematic to those who see themselves as first. It's at least threatening to those who see themselves as first. So if we hear the teachings of Jesus and it doesn't initially sound like good news, before you reject it, ask yourself from which position in which societal pyramid you're encountering those teachings from. If you're at the top, you are going to be definitely challenged by the teachings of Jesus. If you're at the bottom in one of those pyramids, you're going to shout for joy and say, this is good news. There are, well, we won't go into any more of that. But if you find yourself being challenged by the good news of Jesus, again, ask yourself from where you're hearing those teachings. And if you're in the same demographic that was challenged by those very teachings 2,000 years ago, then whether you perceive it as good news or not, or as a threat or not, if the story, your story and that story's lining up, you're in the right story. As uncomfortable as it may be, don't exit that experience. Live in that discomfort. Lean into that tension. And if something has to be grieved, then let's grieve it, let it go, and move on. And stop this. How much should I say? I'm almost used up all my time, so I can't really open it up for too many questions, which gives you a certain level of freedom to be able to say things. Please come back at 11. A lot of the reason injustice is preserved is because we're trying to engage in grief avoidance, where we want something to be great again, and that's all I'll say. We need to understand that inequality does not create a secure, more safe future for anyone. It leaves us all at risk. It leaves us all more vulnerable. And if something's going to be great, it needs to be great for everyone, whether it's in the church or outside of it. As a follower of Jesus, our first and foremost priority, it's not whether this is good for us. Is it good for the most vulnerable among us? And when it's good for the most vulnerable, then and only then is it good for everyone.
Thank you once again for listening. Everything we do here at Renewed Heart Ministries is done with the purpose of making these resources as free as possible. And to do so, we need the help of people like yourself. If you'd like to support the work of Renewed Heart Ministries, you can make a one-time gift or become one of our monthly contributors by going to renewedheartministries.com and clicking on the Donate tab at the top right of the homepage. Or you can mail your contribution to Renewed Heart Ministries, P.O. Box 1211, Lewisburg, West Virginia, 24901. Make sure you also sign up for our free resources on our website, and we have a monthly newsletter that we mail out, and there's just much, much more. Remember, everything we do here at Renewed Heart Ministries is for free, and every little bit helps. And anything we receive over and above our annual budget, we happily pass on to other not-for-profits that we feel are making both systemic and personal differences in the lives of those less privileged within our status quo. And for those already supporting our work, again, thank you. Together, we are making a difference, making our world a safer, more just, more compassionate home for us all.